Haggai chapter 1. This prophecy is given, this first prophecy in Haggai is given about 18 years after the decree of Cyrus that had said to the Jews in Babylon or Persia, you can go back and rebuild the temple, I'll give you the word, I'll sponsor you. Go on, go back, I encourage you. And the tragedy is that very few of them did. The vast majority of the exiles preferred the soft life in Persia, and you see from the book of Esther how assimilated they were into the land of their captivity and how wealthy they were. That's why Haman says, kill the Jews and I'll expropriate all their property and wealth. I'll give an absolute fortune into the treasuries of the king. They were wealthy. They'd done well. They weren't remaining there weeping by the rivers of Babylon. They were doing well for themselves and were very assimilated into society whilst keeping up their sort of traditional culture that we are Jews, etc. And yet, when they're actually given the chance to be in God's kingdom, to restore it with God's spirit and power behind them, most of them don't want to go. And those who do go, as you see from Haggai, are very spiritually weak and are not well motivated. I think the context of this prophecy is in Ezra 5, where there is a ban on the work of rebuilding. There's opposition from the Samaritans, and a message has come from Persia saying, no, no, you've got to stop it. And they're very discouraged. And Haggai arises and gives this prophecy, and actually they do resume. It's easy to think that the prophets were just droning on and no one ever took any notice of them. Well, at least temporarily, the prophecy of Haggai was responded to, and when they wanted to start rebuilding, then actually Persia lifted the ban on rebuilding, and it just shows if you want to go God's way, you will be confirmed in that. So they came back, but I think their response to the call to go to the kingdom, as it were, was from the wrong motives, because God says here, their attitude was, verse 9, you looked for much and it came to little. When you brought it home, I blew it away. Why? Because my house lies waste while each of you is busy with his own house. Their idea was that they would go back to, or not go back, most of them had been born, of course, in Persia, Babylon. The idea is that they would go there, carve out their bit of land, build a nice house, have good harvests, and have a better life than what they had had in Persia. So their motives for responding were very compromised. This is why God says, for your sake, therefore, the skies withhold the dew. I've sent a drought on the land. And he's saying that what you're looking for was great harvests and a cool life. No, that's why actually you got back here and I've given you droughts. And I've given you diseases that have eaten up what harvest you did manage to gather, because you're just doing this for you. And this is a big challenge. This is an absolutely very big challenge to all those who have said yes to the call of the life of the kingdom. Because come out of Babylon, flee from Babylon, be separate from Babylon, return to the land. This is the message that is alluded to in the New Testament and applied to us, that we have come out from this world and we are the equivalent of those who have returned or have gone to Judah to restore and to rebuild God's kingdom. That's what we're all about. But the problem is that they externally obeyed, but they had their own agendas. And we have to really search ourselves. You know, on a simple level, why do you go to church? Is it because you're hoping to find a partner? Is it because you're simply lonely? Is it because you like the singing or whatever? Is it simply because, you know, you like to get out of the house for a bit, you're tired or whatever? What is our motive on this whole saying yes to this message of the kingdom? Is it all about what we think we can get out of it? Probing a little bit deeper. Maybe you have studied the Bible and you have got very clear in your mind certain truths, for example, a position on, let's say, hell, that hell is not in fact a place of fire, it is the grave. And you know, Well, the Bible teaches about that particular topic, and you know how to answer any objections and any difficult passages, difficult from the point of view of your take on this matter. And you love nothing better than to get involved in an argument with somebody and prove them wrong and yourself right. Are you not actually riding your own ego there? Sure, there is a place for correcting people. There is a place for teaching and preaching God's truth. Absolutely. But I'm talking about the motive behind it. They were focused upon their houses and not upon the house of God. God says, "My house lies waste while each of you is busy with his own house." This is 18 years after the decree had been given. And he criticizes them that they lived in their panelled houses. Well, that is, in fact, the same phrase that's used about how Solomon did the internal decorations to the temple, to Solomon's temple. So he's saying, look, you're not rebuilding the temple, are you? You're focused on yourselves. So consider your ways, he says, and go up to the mountain, bring wood and build the house, verse 8. Why were they lacking in wood to build the house? It is specifically stated in the decree of Cyrus, and it's recorded in Ezra 3, that he had specifically stated that cedar wood should be brought from Tyre and Sidon, absolutely enough for the temple to be built. Where had that wood gone? Why has Haggai got to tell them, look, you better go up into the mountain and cut some wood down and bring it down to finish off the temple? What happened to the wood that Cyrus had arranged for them to have? I don't think it's rocket science of sort of biblical interpretation to figure that they had used it on their own houses. Wow, look at this lovely cedar. Let me just put that in my house. Let me do my house like that. And so he says, my house is waste and you live in your panelled houses. Well, what comes first? A lot of people will say our family comes first. Well, you can understand house as a family. God says to David, I will build you a house. He means I'll make you a family. And yeah, sure, absolutely, family is of critical importance, but actually God comes first. And God's house comes first before our house. I'm trying to think how this may apply, as I say, to us. God's house or my house? What comes first? For them, it's my house, and God's house lay waste. And of course, you can, of course, argue that, what I do for my family, I do for God. But there is a difference. There is absolutely a difference. And unless he and his ways are going to come first, we are going to go wrong. And it is as simple as that. He says, consider your ways. Well, in Isaiah 55, God laments that your ways are not my ways. And I don't think that that is stating that sort of by nature it's impossible for you to possibly ever have God's thoughts or God's ways. Yeah, he says, my ways are not your ways and your thoughts are not my thoughts. Now, that, I don't think it's saying that you can never think the thoughts of God. This is the whole idea of having God's spirit or mind or thinking in us so that we can think God's thoughts. Whatever you predicate about human nature, generally, you say about the Lord Jesus, who fully had human nature. So to say that, well, if you're human, you can't possibly think God's thoughts, I don't think that's correct. I think that those words are a lament. My ways and my thoughts are not yours. This is a lament, and this is why he says here, consider your ways. And consider, this is quite a theme in Haggai. Set your heart upon your ways, your thoughts. What is the direction of your life? And the direction of their lives was, I want to have a farm that is a good piece of land, it's got good harvests, and that's going to give me a good solid income, and I want to have a really nice house. That was their way. And God is saying, consider your ways. Now, these ancient situations suddenly become relevant to us, because that is not far off. In essence, what is the capitalist dream. I want a stable income, solid income, going to last me and my family the rest of my life, and I want a nice house. And that is the way of most people. And he says, consider your ways. Is that what you want? Or do you want my house? And because they didn't want God's house, they put their ways before his ways, therefore they considered that it was all sort of unfair, that they weren't getting good harvests, etc. But God withheld those harvests to try to get them to come out of this sort of capitalist dream. And God will work in our lives likewise to sort of upset the capitalist dream. Seek first the kingdom of God, the house of God, and his righteousness. And all these things will be added to you. I don't mean you get a smart life and a smart house, not at all, but you get enough to survive. And that is God's promise. Now, who were these people who returned? Well, I think you can work out that it was generally those who didn't quite make it in Babylon who did return. As I said, you can reason from Esther, the book of Esther, that actually a lot of them, the Jews, had done very well, thank you, in Persian society. And they were well placed within that society, people like Mordecai, it's a form of the Marduk, the god of Babylon, working there in the palace, a civil servant, and so on. Well, why I suggest that it was the people who hadn't quite made it is, well, one strand of the argument would be Ezra 2, which talks about a total of 49,837 people returning. And yet, we're told that only 8,100 animals went with them to transport them. And don't forget, they were also carrying the vessels for the temple. It would appear, therefore, that a lot of them walked. That's a very long way to walk from Persia to Jerusalem. It's a very long way. Everyone surely would have sensibly done it using animals that they could ride on. But the fact that from that it seems a fair number of people went back who didn't have animals, I would assume that a lot of these folks were poor folks who hadn't quite made it, and they thought that we might be able to get the capitalist dream there in Judah. We could get some land, build a house on it, have a good time. And, oh, yes, all this religious stuff. Yeah, well, the main thought, though, is that can I get something out of this? And this is a major problem, as I say. People who are attracted to basically being involved with a religion, including true Christianity, for the sake of what they might get out of it. And as I say, what you may get out of it isn't necessarily talking about money or wealth or presence or whatever, but what I can get out of it for my ego, proving myself right, giving myself some kind of power in life, some sort of respect in life that I didn't have elsewhere in my life, in society generally, in the secular sense. You can see someone who's not quite made it in life, very well, and yet, oh, in the church, oh, they muscle into a church, and oh, yeah, they love the idea of having some power and authority, etc., and some respect there in the church. This is the sort of thing I'm talking about, and this is where these ancient histories become so absolutely relevant to us today.